My name's Cricket, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. My sobriety date's October the 19th of 1969. And I'd like to thank the committee, and I'd like to thank Joe and Debbie, and I'd like to thank old Linda for being such a wonderful hostess. I've had a good time. I didn't know I was going to make it. We get halfway between Atlanta and Fort Myers, and the pilot comes on. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, we got an engine going out." And I said, "Okay." And we went back to Atlanta, and they were putting us on a different airplane, and everybody was getting all mad at this pilot. And we're getting off the plane to go somewhere else, get on another plane to come here. And they're cussing and they're carrying on. I felt so sorry for that pilot. And I walked up to him. I said, "Sir?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am." I said, "I want to thank you." And he said, "Excuse me." And I said, "Thank you for making the decision to protect us." And everybody behind me didn't cuss him out. You know, it just... It was kind of a neat deal, and I found out there's a lot of neat deals in this whole world. And I don't know why I'm speaking as an institution person. You usually think of those as convicts. I don't wear stripes real well. Probably the reason I haven't been in prison, I was one time and they kicked me out. But I was in a mental institution. And the government says that I can't vote, I can't serve on a jury, I have special permission to have a driver's license, but I can't be convicted of a felony. I guess they know what they're doing. They make the decision. I really enjoyed Miss June last night, and I enjoyed the Al-Anon speaker today. And I'm looking forward to Clancy tonight. This is a beautiful, beautiful place to be. There was Cracker Jacks in a basket in my room and all kinds of goodies and candies, a big old white bathtub, a wonderful bed with clean sheets, and a balcony, you know, and I can slide this door open and I look out and I look around and there's water running through all these trees. And I look a little further, and there's water just everywhere. And it wasn't stopping. I mean, it just went on and on and on. I think they call it the ocean. It's powerful. You know, you want to talk about feeling a part of. You look out on that, and you realize that we're all a part of. We're all adult children of God. You know, that's what we're really, truly a part of. I never thought in my entire life that I would be glad to be in Naples, Florida. I mean, I hear that it's a real upper-class city. You know, but the name, Naples, if you'd given me a choice of places to go before, it had to be something that would go right with beer drinking, beer joints, honky-tonk music. You know, something like Memphis, you know. Something that had a little class to it. Savannah. You know, I had to have, everything around me had to fit into what I thought my persona in life was. They tell us to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I don't know how there's any way you can be real general about that. My natural father sired 17 children, so generally I would say he was a very potent man. We didn't all of us know him, so generally I would say he moved around a lot. My mother's full-blooded Black Irish, and she's extremely superstitious. She believes that one child in every family is born evil and possessed of the devil. And you determine it by their weight at birth, and I weighed 2.5 pounds, so I was born evil. And I really wasn't born evil. I became evil. I worked very hard to become evil. I earned that title, if you will. I've broken every commandment that God laid down. I'm not real proud of that, but I can't afford to be real ashamed of it. Because if I get real ashamed of that, I go way, way back into being sick again. And the thing that allowed me to violate every law by God and mankind would die. And it would, that thing that's dead would come alive again. And what would happen is I would quit stealing. and I would not have a conscience. And if I don't have a conscience, then I don't know responsibility. And if I don't know responsibility, I don't know freedom. You know, you would think that a woman who cannot be convicted would have all the freedom in the world. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor that laid down rules. Because it's the rules that I have that make me a free person. It's knowing how far I can go and the price I have to pay today for violating those rules. And in a very general way, I will tell you what my moral standards are today. I ask myself, will it cause jealousy? Now, chances are, if there's a cute little Al-Anon in the room, and I walk up and hover all over her husband, it will cause jealousy. Therefore, it's wrong. Will somebody get hurt? Chances are, if I steal your car, set your house on fire, grab you in the hallway and show you that I'm not afraid of you, somebody will be hurt. Is it selfish? If I find it necessary to sit at a group of Alcoholics Anonymous or at a restaurant and talk about my fellow members or those who should be and judge their program and find them lacking, then my ego is taking over, and yes, I'm selfish. So the entire moral standards that I have today are based on those three principles out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My family, my mother and father, did not stay together. She was very fortunate, I believe. She married a gentleman that took her, and this is way, way back yonder in the early 40s. And we made our living following the crops all over the United States. And I liked picking crops. I love picking crops. I still like dirt. I like the feel of it. There's a cleanliness to it. And I loved it when we picking fruits and vegetables. We knew when. We knew when it was the time to take that. If we took it too soon, it was not edible. If we took it too late, it was not edible. So we had the timing on taking what we were supposed to take that God had given to people was real, real important. And I believe that the timing of recovery is real, real important for myself. The only thing I did not like about following crops was that every time the picking season changed, we as a family had to move. And every time we moved, we had to start a new school. And every time we started a new school, I did not fit in. People judge crop followers. They used to think that we would steal their children. We stole their money, but we never took anybody's kids. We didn't want them. We tried to leave some with y'all. Your kids were safe, but people had a preconceived notion of what crop followers were. Therefore, they didn't allow their children to associate with us. In the past few months, I've been in the process of trying to obtain a birth certificate. And I had to write off for school records, and I had to write off to the Department of Census because there was an affidavit that if your mother chose to, she could sign, and if she chose not to, you had to do all this other stuff. So I had to do all these other things since I was born at home and my birth wasn't registered. And I got back the school report. And at first I felt real ashamed when I opened it up. 1 year I went 38 days. And it said F, 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 F. Somehow or another, inside the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was intelligent. And when I looked at that, I thought, I'm a dummy. I'm a dummy. And I was real embarrassed about that, and I didn't want to tell anybody. That was going to be my secret. And the first person I shared it with was my daughter. And she told me, she said, Mama, that's because of where you were planted at that time. I'm surprised you went to school 38 days. You know, and I am too. But all of that, everything that happened in my life, and I believe in everyone else's, becomes a part of the roadmap that we're supposed to follow. Each one of us is a certain indicator on the highway of life. Some of us are yield signs. Some of us are definite stop signs. Now, I'm one of them, caution, beware, stop signs. Some people are the go signs. You know, they have the serenity. They have the dignity. They have the compassion. And they're that green light. You know, come on, you can go through. Look both directions and go through. Go through this gently. That's what the big book is all about to me. It's a roadmap to get me from where I was at to where I am today, to lead me to where I'm supposed to be tomorrow. I don't have a pattern in my talk, okay? So y'all are going to have to go back and forth like little yo-yos with me, okay? Because I'll go back to what it used to be, and it's all kind of co-mingled. But that was one of the things in the insane asylum they told me I didn't know how to do, was co-mingle. So I'm doing the best I can to co-mingle. And just bear with me. As we did that crop following and we did those schools and we picked those fruits and vegetables, it became apparent to this little girl that I had to have a safe place. Now, I don't know how many of y'all are familiar with wood stoves, but they're absolutely wonderful. And an entire part of our existence was centered around that wood stove. We heated the water for the once-a-week bath on top of that wood stove. We cooked meals on that wood stove. We heated the home on that wood stove. And that wood stove had another characteristic to it that became very, very good for me. I sit behind it. And I could go behind that stove, and for a temporary part of my life, I was safe. Nobody else could sit back there with me, and I was safe. And I would crawl behind that wood stove, and I would pretend. And I would pretend before I ever took my first drink of alcohol. And I would try to pretend the outside of Cricket away. Because, see, if I looked different, you might accept me. If my hair were a different color, you might allow your children to play with me. If my skin weren't so broken out from lack of physical hygiene, you might accept me. If my hair were a different color, if I was tall enough. And so I'd get behind that stove and I would pretend. And I always would pretend that something about the outside of Cricket was different. Two of my brothers were career men by this time. They were armed robbers, and they didn't want me telling on them. So they made a little hole in the wall behind the stove, and that's where they hid their money, and that's where they hid their guns. And in exchange for me not telling on them, they brought me a present. Now, my family doesn't give gifts, but they brought me a present in a little brown sack. It was cute. It was a little bottle of whiskey. And I had never drank whiskey. And I remember sitting behind that stove and thinking, this is neat. And I opened up that little bottle of whiskey, and I started drinking. I was 12 years of age, approximately, and I never will forget it. I drank my last drink just like I did my first one. It didn't matter. I was going to drink it till it was gone. That whiskey burned my throat. That whiskey burned my chest. That whiskey burned all the way down. That whiskey burned all the way back up again. And I drank until the bottle was empty. I left home, and I started living on the streets of Denver. Shortly before I left home, I went to that God. And I said a prayer to him. And I have not forgotten that prayer. I said, "Dear God, sir, my name's Cricket, and I don't really believe in you. I don't believe in family. I don't believe in cleanliness, and I do not believe in goodness. But just in case you are, this is my last prayer to you. Help me to never feel again. And big boy, I don't want any special favors. I don't even want to feel good." That prayer was answered when I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on October the 19th of 1969. I was incapable of feeling anything. They labeled me as a sociopath, you know. I don't know what that means. Maybe I am one. I don't care. I stayed on the streets of Denver doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. The state of Colorado interfered. They sent me to the Colorado State Reform School in Morrison, Colorado, to punish me for being incorrigible, because they said little girls did not live in fields and dig food out of garbage barrels and live the lifestyle that I was living at that age. And I thought, why not? You know, why not? And they put me in the reform school to punish me, and it was absolutely wonderful. It was up in the mountains. There were two sheets on the bed. We never had two sheets on a bed. There was indoor toilets. We never had that. Electricity, three meals a day. I liked being punished. I liked being punished real good. I stayed in the reform school, and I guess I became corrigible, and they released me. And I went right back to the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. At approximately the age of 16, the state of Colorado interfered one more time. They did not recognize teenage alcoholism. They sent me to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado. It's an old coal town. It was not a hospital to me. It was not a treatment center. It was the Colorado State Insane Asylum. And that was back in the middle 50s. Since they did not recognize teenage alcoholism, they had to come up with a diagnosis, and they diagnosed me as schizophrenic with paranoid reaction and psychotic tendencies. That's a lot to be when you're only 16. Oh, wow. I was sober 8 years, and my sponsor said, well, schizophrenic means you're two-faced, and you are. Paranoid means you think people talk behind your back, and they do. And psychotic means you'd rather kill them than yourself, and I would. Even today, you know, I'm one of them homicidal fools. If I start, I'm not going to stop. And with all these years of sobriety, I will not back down from a fight. There's just something inside of me that if you push, 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 I'm going to come out. Now, probably, chances are, at my age, I'm going to get whooped more often. But you're going to be real embarrassed to be telling people, well, that, you know, old lady, she's the one who left this here. Because I don't have enough sense to back down. In the Colorado State Hospital, to make me not be those things, they gave me 10 milligrams of Librium, 25 milligrams of Valium, and 50 milligrams of Thorazine 4 times a day. 3 times a week, they administered electric shock treatment. Let me tell you what was good about all that. The compulsion to drink was removed. These people are wise people, you know. They went to school a long time to learn how to make these decisions. And I was scared in a way. You know, I'm a little girl. And they lie me on a gurney Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And they put a big row of gauze in my mouth. They hold me from my neck to my ankles. They grab my chin. They put gooey stuff here and an electric band here. And they grab my chin and tilt it all the way back. The only thing I have any control over are my eyelids. And the psychiatrist, if you will, raises his hand to the electrical lever and asks me if I'm afraid. Now, one of us is dumb. And I always thought if he laid where I was laying, he wouldn't ever ask that question again. Because there were times we had to be medically resuscitated. The dosage wasn't regulated the way it is today. I have brain damage from the shock treatment. People tell me I'm not sophisticated. Well, that's okay. You know, they used to just tell me I was an idiot. And that's okay, too. They tell me I'm simple. That's what the program's all about, keeping it simple. My sponsor sent me to a psychiatrist when I had about 15 years, and she wanted him to see, you know, what damage and what was wrong with me. He said, well, the brain damage is in the speech area of her brain, the part that controls the speech. I don't think speaking the way y'all think speaking. It doesn't come natural to me. Speaking does not come natural to me. And he said, but her real problem that you're having a problem with, Betty, is Cricket is socially retarded. And she said, excuse me. He said, she's not retarded. She's not slow, but she's socially retarded. She's never going to be sophisticated or dignified. And you know what? That's okay. Because one of the things that thrilled me the most is picking up a little bitty baby and having them cry and having them spit up on me and being safe enough to do that in my arms. No, I'm not sophisticated. Now, I probably won't embarrass you at a dinner table most of the time. I probably would if you made an issue out of it. Then I would do it just for honoriness, you know.
You know, if somebody said, now we use this for it, I'd say, mm-hmm, just wait. And I'd be spinning it all meal long. My sponsor isn't alive anymore, and so I take a few more liberties than I did while she was still alive. Just a few. In that state hospital, because of the Thorazine, I couldn't go out into the sunshine. I weighed approximately 300 pounds when I left. I was released about a week prior to my 18th birthday. On my 18th birthday, the state was going to sterilize me so that I could not produce another cricket. And they were going to go in behind my eyebrow with an ice pick and do something to make me not feel, but I didn't feel anyway. And I'm real grateful they didn't do the sterilization, because I got to give birth to a child. And, you know, I got to have her. I got to carry her. And I got to take her home. And I got to learn that I could be a positive influence in somebody's life. She's now 20 years of age. I thought she had an incurable disease a few years back. It's called puberty. You know, I woke up and I thought, who is this? I'd woke up drunk a lot of times saying, who is this? But I hadn't been drunk since I had that little girl. I thought, who is this? And I said, you know, I don't know how to do rules. I don't know how to parent. I don't know about grounding and sitting and discussing feelings. I don't know how to do those kind of things. So we're going to have one rule. That rule is we will not put fear in one another. So if I'm going to be late, I will extend you the courtesy to call you so that you will not be afraid. And if you're going to be late, you will extend me the same courtesy. We will know what each other is doing, when we're doing it, and probably why we're doing it. And so we both survived puberty. And plus, I had told her I wanted to know when she was through with puberty. And she said, why? And I said, because when you're all through, I'm going to go into menopause. I did. I'm in menopause. That's adult payback to teenagers. It really is. Bless her heart. She said, Mama, you having a hot flash? Oh, yeah. I can't help it. I'm getting weaker. Cunning, baffling, and powerful, the female mind, whether alcoholic or non-alcoholic. That's the main reason I was glad they did not sterilize me. When I left that state hospital, I could not talk. I drooled as if I'd had a stroke. I could not hold my head erect, and I walked with a definite pronounced shuffle. And when I left there, I got on the bus in Pueblo. I went back to Denver, and I found a beer joint. And I shuffled through the doors. And for the next 10 years of my life, I traveled from state to state, city to city, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. I met, I'm sure, some of your husbands in beer joints. They were cute. I got to tell you, Al-Anon, your husbands are so cute when they go to beer joints. Because they come in, and you know, I like dark beer joints. Now, I'm not talking clubs or bar rooms. I'm talking the beer joint. In our town, it would be Hemp Hill Street. Skid Row, that's what I am. I'm a Skid Row tramp, and I liked that part of it. But you know, that afternoon, about 5 o'clock, that beer joint door would open, and he would come in. And in that brief flash of light, he would scope the bar to see if there was a female. And if there was a female there, he would come down and sit about 2 bar stools away. And he would give this most wonderful... And you just kind of look at him and you say, is something wrong? And he says, oh, lady, all I do is work, want to take care of her and the kids. And I know if I stop off for a couple drinks when I get home, she's going to be on me. And gosh, you looked at him and you said, you know what? If I had a man like you, I'd know how to treat him. He sat a little taller. He scooted down a bar stool and he said, "Honey, would you like a drink?" "Oh, yes. If you want to." See, I've had 12 husbands. Two of them were mine. I sit on that barge stool, you know, and your husbands always went home to y'all. They were not stupid. They knew where to go home to. They knew what a lady was. They knew that somebody cared enough to stay and wait. Somebody cared enough to stay and wait. They didn't truly want a woman like me. I was a temporary band-aid for extreme emotional, physical, and spiritual pain. That's all I was to them. And I know that today. You know, it took me a long time when I got into AA. I sit in meetings before and after, and I'd hear the alcoholic men talking about, you know, God, them women are all the same. Put a sack over their head. And I'm a slow thinker. Keeping with the simplicity of it, I had to think about that, and I came up with, put a sack over their head, and men are all the same. You know? And it dawned on me that we were people that did not know how to do anything except use one another. And we didn't care at all. The true love, the true feeling was back in whatever home they had left. That's where the true love and true feeling was. Alcoholic men and women, young people, it doesn't matter. We do things we don't want to do. We say things we don't want to say. We're with people we don't want to be with. We spend money we don't want to spend, and we hurt people we don't want to hurt, and we cannot stop ourselves. We cannot stop ourselves. We have blackouts, some of us. We get sick and we keep drinking. Call it stupidity, call it whatever you want to. Thank God somebody calls it a disease. But we truly cannot stop ourselves. As I traveled the United States, my prayer had truly been answered. I wound back up in Denver, Colorado when I was 28 years of age, sitting on a beer joint on my bar stool, leaving the world alone. I just knew that by the age of 35, I would drive a drunken woman on the street. And that's all I wanted to do. A man and his wife approached me, and he said, "Cricket, my wife and I have watched you for several weeks now, and we think you have a problem drinking." I said, "Excuse me, sir, I don't have a problem drinking." He said, "I'll make a deal with you. I'd like to take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with us tomorrow night. And if we figure out that you don't have a problem drinking, I'll leave you alone." And I said, "Okay, big boy." And he said, "Now when you get up in the morning, don't take a drink." And I said, "No problem." I weighed 78 pounds at this time. My teeth were rotted out of my head. My hair hung down to my butt. When I woke the next morning at one of my sister's homes, he called about noon. I woke up and I was sick. And I reached to the side of my bed for my whiskey. I couldn't take that first drink that day. Today I know that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I reached to the side of that bed and I couldn't do it. And I got so physically ill not drinking that it was horrible. And that fool called my sister's house about noon. He said, "This is Harry. Have you had a drink?" I said, "No, idiot. Don't even want one." He said, "Do you need a ride to the meeting?" I said, "I don't need anything from you, big boy. I told you I'd be at your meeting and I'll be there." I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with two prejudices. I did not like red-haired women, and I did not like gay people. Now, to show you what recovery does, I sponsor two red-haired women today, and I sponsor several lesbian women today. That's God doing for Cricket what I could not do for myself. But I told him no, I didn't need anything from him, and I hitchhiked to my yellow cab to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Denver, Colorado. And I walked into it, and I was a little apprehensive because I didn't know what the word anonymous meant. And I thought it was probably going to be related to the Ku Klux Klan. And I thought, wait a minute. As a crop follower, we knew no racial prejudice. I never knew racial prejudice, thank God. I just had the two prejudices. And I wasn't sure I wanted to go into that thing. I didn't know if they wore sheets, but the word anonymous threw me off. But I had the cab let me off about a half a block away, and I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a red-headed lady came walking up to me. It was disgusting. I mean, she walked up to me. I didn't walk up to her. And she smiled at me. I didn't smile at her. And she said, "Hi, my name's Sharon. Are you an Alky?" I knocked her on her rear end. And I started following instructions. I sat on the back row. They used to say, if you've got it, put it in. If you need it, take it out, as they passed their little wicker basket. I took their money. They said, take what you can use now, what you can't use now, come back and get later. I broke into their office and stole all their office equipment, took it to the pawn shop, pawned it. I was following their instructions. Unbeknownst to me, they started having emergency group conscience meetings. They called the steering committee together. It was kind of funny. You know, I got some long-term sobriety. I got about 3 weeks, and I was approached, and they told me they were not going to tolerate my behavior anymore, and I was so grateful, because all I wanted to do was get back to my beer joint, get on my bar stool, and live until I died. That's all I wanted to do. But see, AA had to kick me out, or else Harry would think I was weak. The same girl that cannot back down from a fight, I can't be the one that doesn't win that dare. So AA has got to kick me out. And when they approached me, I felt this, oh, and they said, "Cricket, we want to kick you out." And I said, "Okay." And they said, "But our traditions won't allow us." And I went, uh-oh. Get rid of them. Whatever won't allow you to kick me out, get rid of it. It's real sick. And they told me that they had some rules I was going to have to abide by. I had to bring back the money I panhandled. I could not allow my sister to give the men my price list. I could not steal money out of the basket. I couldn't turn the tables over if I didn't like what the discussion meeting was all about. I had to pay for the repairs to the Coke machine. I had to go to the pawn shop and get the office equipment I'd stolen. A lot of rules. And I would not come into their group at night any longer unescorted. They had two men meet me at the door. They walked me to my chair, they sat beside me during the meeting, and they escorted me out. I stayed sober 6 months, and the Narcotics Division of the Denver Police Force told me I had to move to Fort Worth, Texas. And I thought, Texas is going to be a breeze, because I've heard that Texans are really backwards. You know, they're silly. They use corn cobs instead of toilet paper. You know, I believed it. I believed it. I'm one of those people that I believe things that I hear. And I said, "Okay, big boys, why am I going to Texas? I didn't go there drunk." And they said, "That's why you're going. Nobody knows you." And I said, "I'll go on 3 conditions. I want a high school diploma, 3 cases of softest toilet paper there is, and a car and a driver's license." Within a week, I had all of those things. It took me 30 minutes to get a GED. And I left Denver with a sister that was absolutely one of the most wonderful caretaker. She read for me. She wrote for me. She did a lot of things for me. And we went straight from Denver to Fort Worth. I had a problem with the car. It had 3 pedals, and I've got 2 legs. And I never did know how to work it right. So somehow or another, I killed it once I got to Fort Worth. But I did the next thing I'd been told to do. I called the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, "Do you need a ride?" I said, "Let me tell you, fool, I ask you for directions to your meeting. I don't need anything from you but directions. Can you handle that, big boy?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And so I hitchhiked to my first meeting in Fort Worth, Texas. And I walked into the door, and a redheaded lady came walking up to me. It was nasty. I mean, she opened up her arms, and she started to, you know, hug me. And I knocked her on the rear end. And it didn't take me long. Here is where I heard about Al-Anon. And I heard about Al-Anon from the same men. I heard about their wives in the beer joint. And what I heard was, "Well, you know, she didn't like me drinking. She don't like me sober. She didn't like me going to them beer joints. She don't like me coming to these meetings." And I felt really sorry for the AA men. And they kept telling me that the Al-Anons were sicker than we were. Now, I'll tell you what. I sponsor an Al-Anon today. I read the Al-Anon literature. I challenge anybody to crack one of their books. Just, if you don't want anyone to know about it, buy one in secret, take it home with you. Read the Al-Anon literature. It's got things in there that have helped save my heart. It has things in there that have taught me how to be more of a whole person. But at that time, I did not know that. And I thought it was my duty to let the Al-Anon group know how sick they were. And so I went to the hospital, and I asked a gentleman where the intensive care unit was. And after he pointed it out to me, I stole the sign off of the door. And I took it back, and I nailed it to the Al-Anon room door. So, for a fact, when they walked in, their door would say intensive care unit. And then maybe they would know that they were sicker than we were. He was stopping me from my behavior. And I stayed sober at that group approximately 8 years, and somebody got a resentment. They went in and set it on fire. I didn't do it. But when the group moved, I couldn't move with it. Today I realize once again that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because I went to another group in Fort Worth, Texas. A group that I'd been told I'd never fit in. Because the women that went to that group were ladies. They wore the right clothes. They used the proper grammar. Their husbands were career men. And I thought, well, you're right. I'll never fit in. They would never accept a woman like me. But when this group burned down, I had to make a move. And I went to Harbor Group. And a red-headed lady came walking up to me. And she said, Cricket, my name's Betty G, and I'm going to be your sponsor, and I'm real scared of you. And I said, wait a minute, lady. I've been sober several years. And she said, oh, I'm not taking anything away from that. But let's do this. Let's go in this back office here. And if I think you understand what the program of recovery is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, I'll leave you alone. Not the fellowship, the program of recovery. I said, yes, ma'am. And we went in the office at Harbor, and Betty G. opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and handed it across the desk to me and said, here, please read me the first portion of chapter 5. And I started reading to Betty G. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I read on and on and on. And Betty G. took the big book of AA out of my hands, and she said, Cricket, you cannot read. And I said, excuse me, woman, I just read you the first portion of chapter 5. And she said, no, ma'am, I had it open on chapter 3. And see, another secret was out. I knew how to tell men's from women's bathrooms. I knew how to order on a menu. I could fake it, fake it, fake it. Another secret was out. My sister did a lot of those things. She wrote letters to people and signed my name. You know, she was great. And I asked Betty, what are you going to do with that information? Texas Christian University to a thing called remedial reading, and a little 86-year-old lady taught me how to read. The reason that I believed everything I ever heard in my life from people was because I didn't have the foundation to know for myself. When a minister told me that the Bible said anything I prayed for in the name of Jesus I'd receive, I took his word for it. When people told me that Texans use corn cobs, I took their word for it. When people told me what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous said, I took their word for it until I learned how to read. See, and I believe that for the people that are involved in organized religion, the Bible is probably a love letter. I believe for me, my love letter is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is written by the first 100 men and women. And I believe that they would have written that to me if nobody else ever got sober. I believe that those men and women cared enough that there was an alcoholic somewhere someday that was going to need their solution. I believe that. And so I believe that this is my letter. And this has my truth in it. That lady told me that she was going to take me on an incredible journey with many, many years of sobriety. I was pregnant with my first and only child, and my sponsor took me to a thing called Step One. You know, we admitted we were a powerless over alcohol, that our lives was unmanageable. And you know, I can tell you the lapse of that journey. Steps 1, 2, and 3 removed any barricades between my God and me. steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 removed any barricades between myself and me. Steps 8 and 9 removed any barricades between you and me. Steps 10, 11, and 12 keep the barricades down. That's the lapse of that journey for me, all summed up in one little thing, if I had to tell you about the roadmap of my life in recovery. When this woman told me that I had to change, I thought, okay. And you know what she did? I'm not allowed to curse very often, even when she's not alive. See, I know when I'm going to say those bad words from up here. And I have enough now that I know it before it's coming out and I can stop it. I used to not know it. It just came out. I had to quit stealing. I didn't want to. You know, stealing is really economical. It is. I had to get a legal job. I had to change the way I dressed. My dresses had to start covering me up. I had to learn how to use the forks and the knives at a dinner table. I had to learn how to bathe. I had to go to a dentist and get my teeth out and get dentures put in. And I like that because when I take them out at night, I look like a cabbage patch. You know, I always want to look like a doll. And, you know, that woman and them people that would never accept a person like me, they are the reason that my daughter has never lain in the floor and seen a foot coming down her head. She's never been called a dirty name by me. She's never been told she was stupid. My daughter finished high school. My daughter went to 2 years at college. She works for Senior Citizens. She's married. They're buying a new home. She married a wonderful young man. See, and that's my daughter. And that's not what I could have done on my own. The members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Alateen, when I called my sponsor when she was real little and told her to come and get her because I was going to hurt her, they came over and they taught me how to be a parent. I have a clean house. I live in a house that's valued at $20,000. But you know what? I don't think I'd take $1 million for it. My house has 17 windows. No two rooms in my house are the same color. And I've got porcelain dolls everywhere. And I've got books. And I've got comfortable chairs. I've got places in my house. Anybody can walk in and find a place to curl up. You know, curl up. I believe that everybody needs a curl-up corner. I believe you need a place where you can get your knees up around you and you can just kind of rock and know that God is. I think we need that. See, those people took this fragmented nothing, and it was like it was a giant jigsaw puzzle, and they dumped it in the group down there at Harbor, and all the pieces fell out on the floor, and they were not very pretty pieces. And it's as if God stepped into that group of people and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to help you out. When people try to put a jigsaw puzzle together, there's always one piece missing. And they search all over for that. So I'm going to find the piece of cricket for you that's missing. And I believe that my God found my heart. And I believe he put that place in there. And he said, at this point, I'm taking out of her a heart of stone and putting in her a heart of flesh. And I believe that you all worked around that place. See, I had gone back before that God because my sponsor got sick. And I said a prayer to the effect of, dear God, sir, my name's Cricket. And many, many years ago, sir, I asked you to help me not to feel again. And I've been sober a long time. And I have that child. And when them people touch me, as soon as I can, I have to run and wash them off of me. I don't want...
You have reached the end of...
I have to hold their hands. I have to go and wash it off real quick. Sir, if there's any way possible, I'd like you to help me feel again. And I know I'm not going to get any special favors. I'm probably even going to have to feel bad. My sponsor and I raised my child with the help of those other people. She called my sponsor Granny. You know, the bleeding deacon at Harbor Group was her Uncle Jack and her Uncle Jim. That's where she got her roots, was in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor made me make amends so I wouldn't have that barricade between me and you. She made me do that. I used to steal checks out of the mail, old age pension checks, before they started doing direct deposits. Government always finds a way to spoil your fun. Once a month, I'd hit your mailbox before you did. But I didn't keep a record of who I stole them from. You don't ever plan on paying it back when you're a thief. Or at least I didn't. I know there's some noble thieves that steal the money from the group with every intention of paying it back. I'm not a noble thief. In exchange, because I couldn't go to those people and make direct amends, she made me call bingo at Harbor every Saturday night for 7 years, for 3 hours. If I was in Fort Worth, Texas, I was calling bingo because it was primarily the senior citizens who played. If your old age pension check was missing way back yonder, let me know and I will make restitution. I do not want to call any more bingo. My sponsor gave me the keys to her house, to her car. She had things called CDs, and not music, some paper things called CDs that I could sign on and let me do all kinds of stuff, you know. It was neat. I didn't ever sign on a CD, but I did drive her car. I took her where she needed to go. I cleaned her house. I started giving back to her. And on Valentine's Day a few years back, she wanted yellow tulips, and she wanted sausage and biscuits and a lavender nightgown. My sponsor was a judge's daughter. She had some big old degree behind her name. And she was this tall. She was about 7 inches taller than I was. And she loved me. And every day I'd go into her home and I'd say, Betty G, I'm here. And she'd say, I'm in here, darling. And she had red hair and called me darling. You know? And I'd go in. This day, I took her 6 live yellow tulips and I put them beside her bed. And I, probably the first time in her life she ever wore anything from Kmart, I put her in a lavender nightgown I bought at Kmart. Not only bought it at Kmart, I caught it on a blue light special. Greatest thing that happened for women like me. I fed her sausage and biscuits and I took her upstairs and I tucked her in bed and I went down to Harbor to call bingo. My daughter was with a sitter and she called her and she said, Granny Betty, good night, I love you. And Betty Garber said to her, I love you too. See, Betty told me that night before I left. She looked up out of that bed and her face was all cracked. See, God's neat. I don't know how many of you have ever been in an antique store and you've seen those porcelain dolls when they're really, really cracked. They've got a story to tell. And Betty's face was all cracked. And there was a tear coming out Betty's eye and it came out right here. And she looked up at me and she said, Cricket, you know I love you. And she told me that many, many times. This night I put my finger and I tried to find out where that tear came from. And I traced it up that little crack like a little road map right to here. But you know where the tear came from? All the way down deep inside. That tear made its way all the way up just for me. For the very first time, I looked into the eyes of my sponsor, and I said, Betty G, I love you too. And then I ran. You know, I went down to Harbor, and then I went home, and my daughter told me she'd talk to her granny. And I got up the next morning, my daughter and I went over to do my sponsor's breakfast, and I found her in her bathroom floor dead, in her lavender nightgown. And I knelt down beside my sponsor, and I covered her up because my sponsor was a lady. And I put my arms around her and I said, oh, Betty, you know, they had to take my sponsor away. But they didn't take her away. You know, there isn't a box or a plot of ground anywhere that can hold what a sponsor is. Because there was a man named Ike that was one of my favorite cult followers, and he had skin that was color of coal, and it was so beautiful. And when I was a little bitty girl, Ike and I would play, and I'd get to touch his hair and to bounce back, and I'd touch his hair and to bounce back, and I'd touch his hair and to bounce back, and we'd just play. And Ike used to tell me, "Let me tell you something, little girl. Someday you'll run and not be weary. You'll walk and not faint. You just have to wait and you'll manifest the means of evil." So when they took Betty G and they tried to confine her, they couldn't, because she had already taught us how to run and not be weary, how to walk and not faint, and we've mounted up with the wings of an eagle. We truly have. I get to soar on a daily basis. I sponsor the best people anywhere. I have the best friends. I have the best daughter and the best son-in-law. I have a wonderful life. And you know, inside, where I could never be clean, y'all found a way to shower me. And inside, where I could never be filled up, you found a way to fill me up. I am no different than anyone else in this room. My goals are the same. Whether you're alcoholic, Al-Anon, or LT, what do you really want? To lie your head on a pillow and be still and know that God is God. That's what you want. And you know how to do that? Listen to the people who give you the roadmap. There's a Betty G somewhere. My sponsor, they told me that she was not indispensable. And I want to tell you, friends, something. My sponsor was irreplaceable. See, there's a little corner in my heart that's behind a wood stove. And I get back there with Betty G. And she reminds me, principles before personalities. You have enough sense, Cricket, to say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. You've got enough brain cells to know that you need to take a bath. You can still get down on your knees and scrub your wooden floors, because your home is clean because of God. I can't keep anything that I don't give away. And let me tell you what my favorite part of service work is. I love cleaning up the puking drunks. I like dumping ashtrays. I still do that. I've done that here. I haven't cleaned up a puking drunk yet, but I've dumped your ashtrays. Do you know why I do that? Because when I'm able to do that, it reminds me of who I was and what I am. And I know that anything I can give to another person either adds to or takes from their quality of life. And if I judge them, I'm taking from. If I look down my nose on them, I'm taking from. If I look into every human being that I see and ask myself, do I want to wound this soul today? Do I want to be hard? Do I want to be perverse? Do I want to be hard? Do I want to be cold? No. I ask God, open my mouth so that maybe somebody somewhere will know, God, that you care about them. Open my ears so that somebody somewhere will remind me that you care about me. And open my eyes so that I can see. See, I can see out here. I can see all of y'all. You just got one direction to look. But I can see you. And you have no idea the etching that God has done in Naples, Florida for your 42nd year. If you look around, you can see warmth. You can see peace. You can see some fear. You can see some confusion. And the cloud that hovers all over it is hope. We are responsible to one another because somebody was responsible for us. And we are accountable to our God for what we do with our gift of sobriety. If anything I said offended anybody in this room, I'm sorry. I'm not sorry for what I used to be, because it's part of what I am. Without you, I wouldn't be. When they asked me to learn how to spell my last name, I used to say, N-O-T-H-I-N-G. That's not my last name. My name's Cricket R, and I belong to y'all. Thank you for allowing me to be part of you.